Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Mark Schwarzer, and welcome to the Optus Sport Football Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Phil Kitromilidis and a man I'm not particularly happy about at the moment, Julien Laurent.
Why?
Well, I mean, can you think about it? Can you think why I might not be happy with you?
Is it something to do with Australia or Australian yes. football?
Yes, okay. Yes. You wore a shirt.
I wore a shirt?
You wore a shirt. South Korea, after they beat Australia and knocked us out of the Asian Cup. What is going on, Jules? What I mean, is this revenge because we knocked you out of the World Cup, the Women's World Cup? Is that what it is?
Okay, maybe there's a bit of that. I mean, that penalty shooter still gives me nightmares at night. No, to be fair, I'm sorry. I don't like upsetting you. I didn't think about it. I had the shirts ready before. Like today, I've got Sporting Portugal, which is a lovely one for today. But I should have thought about your feelings.
That was a very like dad like start. Like I want you to think about what you've done.
Yes,
you
exactly. Going,
I'm sorry, yeah. I just didn't
well,
think. I'm
it's,
sorry.
It's almost like that, isn't it? I mean, the age gap and everything else. Anyway, let's move right along. Let's move straight on to the Premier League. We're going to talk about Manchester United against Fulham. Obviously, it ended up Fulham winning. I think the first time in over 20 years at Old Trafford 2-1, which was a remarkable scoreline in one way. Remarkable victory, but in terms of performance and the way that the game flowed, I think it was a pretty fair result, Phil.
It was a very fair result, and it wasn't necessarily that unexpected. I mean, yeah, United had been on a good run of form, but this is not a United side that inspires confidence. It is not a United side that has been consistent throughout this season, and you know that they're capable of these kind of performances in any given game. So Ten Hag after the game saying, you know, look at the bigger picture. Well, what is the bigger picture? Because if you actually look at the bigger picture, it might not look very good for you, mate, because there's a new minority stakeholder who's come in and is possibly wanting to change things up. You've got a very expensive, underachieving squad. You've got a team that just cannot build any kind of momentum and consistency. So I don't know if the bigger picture looks particularly good for United and Ten Hag. And it was just another really disappointing showing. And credit to Fulham as well. And if we talk about injuries, and I'm sure United fans might say, you know, oh, we had players missing through injury and Hoyland is a big loss. A lot of teams have got injuries. And Fulham had some really important players out missing as well. You know, three of their most important players out missing. You know, no Willian, no Paulinha and Raul Jimenez. So they had some key players missing as well. And yet they still managed to put in a really good performance at Old Trafford. So I don't know how many times we've said this, Schwartzy, on the pod this season. After United have pulled out a win late on, could this kickstart United season? Could this be a catalyst for United season? You're not asking me again that because we know it's not, because it can't just be every time they get a little last minute win or they go on a small run. Can they kick on? No, they can't kick on. I think this is their level. They are the sixth best team at the moment in the Premier League. You look at the teams above them, who's got a much worse squad than them? Who's got a worse manager than them? I don't think any of them. So I think they're more or less, broadly speaking, where they should be in the table at the moment.
Jules, Phil just mentioned there about a new ownership or partly ownership. What needs to change for Manchester United to change? Is it off the field? Is it that ownership thing that's happened? Or is there more to it?
I think there's a lot of things, really, starting with the ownership or the structure of the ownership. And I think the Ratcliffe arrival is really good news. One, because he's clearly not there for the same reason as the Glazers in terms of this is his club. He's made enough money, as he said himself in his business life, that he just wants United for them to win, not to make him richer or more money to him, but just to see his boyhood team winning, really, which is a very different mindset than the Glazers, who are only there for the money. We know that by now. So that's good. I agree with everything Phil said, and I wonder if the other changes that need to happen are one on the bench. I'm not sure about Ten Hag still now. The thing that I'm I struggled the most with. If I was a United fan, I would feel like he's lying to me, because after the game, he said, we deserve to win. We were a better team. But no, you were not. Everybody could see you were not. And actually, when Maguire scored that 89th minute goal to make it 1-1, Ten Hag should have said to his players, we've been lucky already to have a draw now, to get a point from this game. Let's make sure we don't concede. Don't try to go and win it now, because we can't really. We're not good enough in this game. So let's make sure that we get the draw and that's it. It won't be a great result, but it won't be as bad as losing. And what do? They go all over the place. Everybody was going forward. It was an absolute shambles of the last 6-7 minutes of the game, and they concede on a counter. And that's it. And I'm just like, one, Ten Hag, in a way, is not telling the truth by saying that they were the better team, they deserve to win, because this is not true. Everybody knows it, including his own players and his own fans. And two, I feel like his management of the last 10 minutes of the game, let's say, was really poor, because he should have been lucky to get a draw and should have said to his players, let's just sit deep now, make sure that we keep that 1-1 draw and that's it. And instead, it was all over the place.
I mean, it's kind of mixed messages, right? Because Harry Maguire goes and scores the equaliser and then goes off celebrating rather than grabbing the ball and running back to the halfway line. So there was kind of a mixed message in terms of almost like a belief or a satisfaction they've got back in the game. They've equalised, but not really with the belief to go and win it. But then they go and push all these players forward and expose themselves. And you can't do that when you've got Adama Traore come on the pitch, can you? I mean, Phil, he is an absolute, like, a train. I mean, he's been out injured for most of the season. He's got that. It's so well known. You can't give him any space on the ball whatsoever.
And he did what he was specifically brought on to do. I mean, that's why Marco Silva brought him on to do that. And he did it. And he's had a season that's been disrupted through injuries. And I think this is maybe the first really meaningful thing that he's done so far this season. But yeah, I mean, United should know that. They should know that. And I mean, what do you think, Schwartz? I mean, we've spoken so much about United this season and we still don't really know what to expect from this team. We still don't really know how they should be playing. It just fills us with questions like every single week. And I said they're sixth in the table and that's where they should be. Do you think that's where they should be? Should they be higher?
No, I don't think they should be higher at all. And I think you're right. this was a golden opportunity for them because they've been on a decent run. This was an opportunity for them to continue that momentum. And almost set out a marker there and go, right, okay, we're going to put pressure on the likes of Villa. You know, let's see how you're going to handle this for the remainder of the season. Obviously, that didn't work for them. And then there are some positives. Look, Onana is starting to deliver. He's starting to perform better each week. So that there is that positive. I mean, the other one that I was just reading about again on the weekend, I kind of almost forgot about him, was Anthony. I mean, yeah. I mean, I was never, I never thought he was an £80 million player when they first bought him. But it seems like the writing's on the wall for him as well, Jules.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way back from really, in a way, her humiliation. Because what happened Saturday, on his birthday, by the way, that was his 24th birthday on Saturday, to have been humiliated like that by someone in Ten Hag who pushed and did everything he could to sign you, spend all that money on you, someone who worked with you before, who got you to play at a really good level at Ajax, and Anthony, the last season before he moved to United, was a really good player. We have to be honest here. To first start that young Fawson, who had never started for United, in the position of Anthony on the right wing. Then when Fawson came off, just before the hour mark, Garnacho moved from left to right, still no Anthony. Then Bruno Fernandes moved to the right, still no Anthony. Then Amad Diallo came on, still no Anthony. And then he brought him on in the 98th minute. He played 55 seconds, touched the ball once. I mean, again, I just don't think there's a bigger humiliation than this. And again, I don't think Anthony, whose confidence was already low, I just don't think there's a way back for him personally to recover from this. And him and his relationship with Ten Hag, surely he's gone now.
The other thing I just want to touch on is Casemiro swapping his shirt at halftime with Munez. I don't know how I feel about that. I believe that sort of stuff should happen after the game. I don't think that should be happening at halftime. I know sometimes it's like a split second, change your shirt, off you go. I don't know. I mean, I've seen it time and time again. I had teammates who did it. Me personally, if I'd ever were asked, which very rarely ever happened in that terms at halftime, but I would have always did say when it happened like once or twice, now I'll do it after the game. I wouldn't do it at halftime.
You know, I think I've got no issues with if Munoz were approaching Casemiro, but do it when the cameras can't see it. So wait until you go into
Absolutely.
The tunnel.
I agree.
Into the dressing room. It could be half time, but do it then. Don't do it on the pitch like that, because it does look like a little bit like a charity match. And at half time, you meet your mate and you played against each other and you say, yeah, let's swap the shirt. It doesn't really look that professional, but if nobody sees it, it's fine. You can do it at halftime. I don't think it changes the dynamic. However, it's not the best of look when everybody sees that Munoz is going to Casemiro in a game like this, at this level, and say like, oh, all I've been thinking of in this first half was not so much the game and playing football. It was just that I can get your shirt at halftime before anybody else from my team is asking you for your shirt.
Arsenal played Newcastle on the weekend and won 4-1. Arguably, and I think you've got a really good discussion point or certainly ground to say that Arsenal, out of the top three teams, are performing the best and are at their best at the moment. Is that fair to say that, Phil, out of the top three?
Yeah, much as it pains me to say, as regular listeners to the podcast will know.
That's why I thought I'd come to you straight away.
Yeah, no, my allegiances are with the other team in North London, but obviously I try to maintain professional impartiality on the podcast. And yeah, man, Arsenal are the best team in the Premier League at the moment, certainly in terms of entertainment, in terms of the way that they play. The goal scoring is really quite ridiculous, the amount of goals that they've scored.
25 goals in six games this year. They beat Liverpool and Newcastle in the current run of those six games as well.
So I went back and I looked at their first six games of 2023, and they won two, drew two, and lost two, and they scored seven goals in that period. Obviously, okay, different year, different fixtures as well. They played Newcastle, Spurs, United, Everton, Brentford and City in the first six of the previous year. And this year they played Palace, Forest, Liverpool, West Ham, Burnley and Newcastle. So maybe slightly easier games this season. But still, I think it just speaks of an Arsenal side that have taken a step up from last year. And it's not just that they're scoring goals, which they are, 25 goals. But if you look at that, 25 goals in the last six games from 10 different scorers as well. And everybody's been going on about, they don't have a true centre forward. And I've mentioned my highly negative Arsenal mates on the podcast almost every week who keep going on about not having a centre forward. But really, if you've got 10 different scorers in that run, that's really impressive. And actually, I went and looked at the top six and who's got the most different scorers in their squad. Arsenal have had 15 players score this season in the Premier League. It's more than anyone else in the top six. Liverpool have had 14. United and Spurs have had 13. And City and Villa have had 12. So they've got goals from all over the pitch. And they've got these set-piece goals as well, which we saw two more against Newcastle, which is something they've worked on again. So they're not just scoring goals from open play. They're very dangerous from set-pieces. And finally, this is the longest I've ever talked positively about art before, I think, in my life.
Keep going. It's very good.
I'm going to talk about one of your lot, Jules, because they've got the best defensive record in the Premier League as well. And Saliba is the player with the most minutes played in the Premier League this season of every single player. That's including goalkeepers as well. He's played 2,340 minutes. And last season, I'm not saying their title challenge fell away when he got injured, but their title challenge kind of fell away when he got injured. Yeah. He's been an absolute rock this season defensively as well. And they're looking really, really good.
So their title chances did fall away when he got injured last season. I know you're not saying it, but you did say it. Like, I'm just
kinda,
saying.
Kinda.
No, I mean, you did say it. No, you did say it. Not that you kind of said it, you did say it.
Yeah.
Phil said as well is that Arsenal are going to win the title and that he's going to be celebrating on, in Islington streets.
I've never seen him so excited about any of his teams. You know, like honestly, when he's talking about how well they're performing, when we talk about Spurs, we used to talk about them regularly, but yeah, surprisingly, Jules, do you see them as? Are they there for the remainder of the season? Is it like, because, you know, we've talked the last couple of years, Arsenal have fallen away. They've hit road bumps and they've fallen away. Are they staying this season?
Yeah, I really think that our title race, which is the most exciting in Europe, to be fair, will go to the wire. And I think all three of them will push each other, will compete. I think they will all drop points at some point. None of them will win every single game. And by the way, City still have to play Liverpool and Arsenal, so they can't all win all their games. So the points will be dropped there and there. at some point between now and so in the next 12 games, the remaining 12 games of the season. But yeah, I think he will go down to the wire. Could he go to goal difference? I'm not so sure. Right now, we have to say that because of the last 6 games for Arsenal, they made up the deficit in terms of goal difference. And now them and Liverpool are 6 clear of City. Again, with 12 games to go, I'm not sure how important that is, but still it's a fact. So I think they have the momentum, but we saw against Porto in the Champions League that the times where, especially against a very well-organized, well-structured defensively team, they could struggle maybe a little bit more. And if their key players don't step up, a Saka, Odegaard, someone like that, and if set pieces in that game is not working, then they struggle. And Porto, I think, was a really good reminder that you can score as many and you can beat West Ham and Liverpool and Newcastle. It's still not always a guarantee that you're going to sweep everybody. So they will have games like the Porto one, even in the league, for sure. But it will be then those moments where your key players have to step up. There's a big debate here in England. I mean, not so much now, but Rio Ferdinand said that Bukayo Saka was not world-class. He said he's a really good player, but right now he's not world-class. And I don't think we need to go over long, but it's a very interesting debate. Some people will think that Saka is world-class, even amongst us three. Others don't. Maybe he's just not there yet, but he's getting closer and closer. The way I see it is that Porto was a really good test in a way for that. If your team is not really working collectively, so the fluidity is not there, you're not creating as many chances, maybe the movement is not, which can happen in any games to any team. That's when I think your world-class players step up. And I think we saw against Porto for Saka that in those kind of games, in the Champions League especially, which is all new to him, this is his first season that he's played in the Champions League, there's still something a little bit missing. He will get there, he's still very young. But I thought against Newcastle, after his disappointment against Porto, and the same could be said for the whole team, he bounced back so well because he was outstanding against Newcastle.
Yeah, because you can't argue with the stats, right? He's now scored in 5 consecutive Premier League goals. And he's actually scored 7 in total in those 5 games. He's got 16 so far this season. So, I mean, they are top class. And you're right, it's whether or not you class him as world class or whether it's just one of the best players in the Premier League. And currently on form, you're pretty hard to find anyone who's in better form than Saka in the Premier League.
Jules, you've brought me back down to earth. Thank you. I was getting carried away with my Arsenal euphoria. But it's actually an interesting one. We don't need to go down the world-class debate route. But if you look at the goals that he scored in the Premier League, and it's 13 goals in the Premier League, he scored against Forest, Fulham, Spurs, Bournemouth, Wolves, Fulham, Forest, Liverpool, West Ham, Burnley and Newcastle. It's against teams, shall we say, lower ranked rather than in the big. Okay, he scored against Liverpool.
And there's a few pens as well, yeah, in there.
There are 4 pens in there as well. So yeah, the numbers are good, but in terms of we're talking about the world class elite status, maybe not quite there yet at the age of 22.
Yeah.
You know, if we come back in 4 or 5 years, we're probably having a different conversation.
I would like to say he's getting there. He's getting there. Yeah, I think it's hard to say that he's world-class right at this moment in time, but he's certainly getting there. He's well on his way. Newcastle, on the other hand, 9th in the league. Obviously, they've kind of hit a wall, haven't they? I mean, their last season was remarkable. Got to the Champions League. Really, really tough group. And they seem to be suffering and they can't get back into a rhythm, Jules. They seem to really be struggling right now.
Yeah, sorry. I was looking at Kitro, who almost choked himself by drinking his bottle of water. I think one of the shows I did with you guys, we talked about Eddie Howe and the lack of plan B in a way. We know how good they were last season because of the intensity they put in games and the incredible physical ability that they have. And they're such a physical team. I don't mean like in a dirty way. I just mean the way they run and they win all the duels and they win all the second balls and they're always there. And then because they also have talented players, if you add the intensity and the physicality to a Gordon, a Isak, Almiron, Bruno Guimaraes, all of that, it's a winning recipe because you've got pretty much every aspect covered. You're good on the ball, you're good out of possession because of that intensity and physicality. You press well, you run a lot defensively, you've got monsters at the back. So all great. The problem is if that intensity level drops a little bit, if the physicality level drops a bit, then what do you do? Is the football side of your team good enough? Probably, but you haven't played like that really. You played mostly, first of all, with the physicality, and then your ball playing players were there and shining. And for me, this ninth season, which is really underwhelming, and I think the Champions League got a lot of the energy and pumped a lot of the energy. I understand that, and they had obviously all those injuries. I get it. But for me, it's a lot on Eddie Howe, really, for never having really found another way of playing by being less intense, less physical, but just make them play a little bit more. Because I think this is a team that can play much better football than anything we've seen from Newcastle this season.
Are they at that level yet, though? That's the question, right? So I think they've done a remarkable job. Yes, they've got really, really rich owners, but they're staying within FFP, which is what we want to see. I think their change in fortune and certainly the way they've played has been very, very good under Eddie Howe. The question is, at this level, like you said, Champions League, winning the title, is Eddie Howe the right person for that job?
Just before Kitro goes on the FFP, really interesting. They will have to sell. And yeah. I know right now it looks like they're not a Forest or Everton where they've been investigated by the Premier League, but they will have to sell in the summer. And I think one of their top players from, again, Gordon, Isak or Guimaraes, I think they're the three most valuable with Botman maybe. One of those four, unfortunately for them and their fans, will have to go.
They spent 70 million on Tonali as well.
And that's been a big killer for him, hasn't it, really?
I think that has been. We may be sort of overlooking how important he was supposed to be in this Newcastle side. A big player that is just unavailable now for extra curricular reasons. So, yeah, I mean, I still do think that Eddie Howe is the right person. And I don't think that they're going to look to get rid of him because of this season. But yeah, it's been disappointing. It's been underwhelming. And it's going to be interesting to see how this huge Newcastle project bounces back from a dose of reality, which this season undoubtedly is proving to be.
I think something that they've shown throughout since they've taken over the new owners is patience. They've had patience and it's gone a lot quicker. I think the transformation for Newcastle to get in the Champions League position accelerated, was far more accelerated than what they probably even hoped themselves. So we're kind of expecting so much more from them, but I think they're still on track.
Is ninth place on track?
No, but in terms of balancing it up, so from finishing in the top four last season to this season, what I'm saying on a balance over the course of the time since they've been in charge. I'm not saying, no, ninth for Newcastle and where they want to go is not good enough. But I think on balance, I think it's okay at this moment in time.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. We will see where they finish, really. Again, there's 12 games to go. Yes. But when you go from a top four finish, a League Cup final that you lost, but it was still a League Cup final, to what we've seen so far this season. And I know the Champions League was incredible for them as much as it was a distraction for them as well. It was incredible. Okay, and in the end, they fell short. And I think psychologically, it was a quite a big knock for them. But ninth and nothing in the Cups, I don't know.
Yeah, but I think that's a bit harsh, right, Jules? Because you can't compare them like a Man United or an Arsenal.
No, true.
You know, so they're the teams that have year after year were either winning titles in that top four and then they drop out. That's a disaster.
Yeah, so they're probably in between, right? Is that what you're saying? They're probably in between ninth and fourth. So they're probably
at the moment. And then, look, the season's not finished and there's every chance they could finish a lot higher, right? So I think in perspective, putting things into perspective, I think they're okay where they are right now.
Took 4 points off PSG in the Champions League.
Oh, exactly. I knew that was coming. I knew that was coming. Yeah. But look at where they are now. Look at where we are.
Man City were away at Bournemouth. I think it's Liverpool and Arsenal went to Bournemouth and won actually very, very comfortably. It wasn't comfortable for Man City, actually. I mean, Edison probably put in one of his best performances this season for Man City over the course of the game. I thought he was outstanding. Bournemouth put on a really good show, but Man City, and they have enough every time, don't they, Phil?
They are getting results, but it just feels different to previous seasons. I don't know. And maybe that feels silly me saying that because they're still winning. And when you go on to win a title, you need to get the results however you can. And City have a way of doing that. But it does feel different. It does feel different to other seasons. I don't know. They don't seem to be steamrolling sides. They don't have the swagger necessarily that we've seen in previous seasons. And I went and looked back. It's back-to-back 1-0 wins in the Premier League. You know, the last time they won back-to-back matches 1-0 in the Premier League, it was 5 years ago. It's not normal for them to sort of be scraping past. And okay, against Brentford, they had chances to win more than 1-0, and then Haaland scored in the end. And here, Phil Foden, who's been sensational, scoring the only goal of the game. Haaland missing some really big chances as well. And he's missed more big chances than anyone else in the Premier League this season, even more than Darwin Nunez. I mean, he's also scored more goals than anyone else and gets more chances than anyone else. But yeah, he just doesn't feel like the clinical cyborg that we saw last season. So I'm not saying that Manchester City aren't going to win the Premier League, and I'm not saying that they aren't going to win every game from now until the end of the season. But I was questioning that narrative last week, and I think maybe the week before as well, that people just said, oh, City will just go on a run now, they'll win every game. And I just don't think it's as clear cut as that, even though I'm sitting there talking about them after they've won, you know, back-to-back games. But it just doesn't feel as convincing as previous seasons.
And never is clear cut, but when you've got the likes of the squad that Manchester City have and the experience and Pep Guardiola as a manager, you feel that that's always a possibility, right? And let's be honest, Haaland, yes. In terms of Haaland's, we're talking about Haaland and the level that we're used to seeing him play each week, he's having a bad run. But it's still Haaland. And I just don't see Haaland going on for the remainder of the season playing like he is right now, Jules, do you?
He's still the top scorer.
Yeah,
he's still the top scorer. I mean, obviously, he missed a few chances. I mean, he seems to be missing more chances than he did last season. And again...
But he was injured, right? He's come back. It's going to take a little bit of time.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
There was a bit of rustiness maybe, or just getting match fit simply. And again, I think, you know, when you play against Everton and the centre-backs that they have, when you play Brentford against the centre-backs, it would be a very physical battle. And when you've been out for 2 months, that's the side of your game that really you're missing. The fitness, the rest, you don't lose... Technically, you don't lose. Tactically, you don't lose anything else. So he would come back. And also maybe that last season was just as amazing as he is, was just like, it's hard to do another season like that, kind of back to back. You know, we've been used to Harry Kane, and Harry Kane will score 30 goals every season, but not 55 in 50 mm-hmm. games or something like that. And you can do it once. I'm not sure how often you can do it unless you're Cristiano or Messi and that kind of guys, which Haaland is not just at that level yet. So, you know, it'd be interesting to see where he finishes the season. Again, he's got 12 games. He can well score 20 in 12. He can also score 12 in 12. He could score 8 in 12. I don't know. And then I think then it would be time to analyze the season with the injury, with the form, with the big chances missed, with his XG, for example, which right now is pretty much where he should be. So it's okay-ish. But knowing him a bit, I think he's quite disappointed with himself right now. In the last few games, he hasn't been, I think, at the level in terms of goal scoring that he wanted to be.
Phil Foden is probably in the form of his career. 9 goals and 7 assists just in the Premier League alone. 15 goals and 10 assists in all comp for Manchester City. So a Manchester City side that is kind of not firing on all cylinders, but Phil Foden is. And how good a player do you rate him, Jules?
I think outstanding. For me, the most interesting thing about Phil Foden, we know how good he's been for years now. So this is not, I don't think the debate is how good he is. The debate is between him and KDB now. I just don't think you can get the best out of Foden if you play him in a different position than centrally, and you can't play KDB anywhere else. Can you play them both centrally? Yes, but we saw when KDB came back that it's not working that great. Yeah, okay. Foden scored 3 against Brentford away, but he was playing wide and then was in the right position at the right time. I think we'll get to a point for Guardiola and City where there will be a case of, if we want the best Phil Foden, this is without KDB. If you want KDB in the team, you'll have to put Foden wide or somewhere else, which won't get the best out of him like we see centrally. And I think they will have to make choices. And I even wondered at the weekend if KDB being on the bench for that long was, maybe he's not fully fit. And okay, fair enough, if he's not, if he can only play 5 minutes, or it's simply because Foden is keeping him out of the team.
I mean, there's talk that he had a bit of a niggle with his hamstring.
True.
Right, so that's why he didn't play. And there's also a lot of rumors, a lot of talk now in the press about potentially Saudi Arabia. Can you see that, Phil? Can you see... I mean, Man City are not afraid to sell players. They're not afraid to let players go, right? Can you see someone like KDB move on in the summer?
That would feel really quite jarring to see Kevin De Bruyne move to Saudi Arabia at the age of 32, being the player that he is. I'm not saying it won't happen, but it would feel like something that shouldn't happen. And yeah, you're right. City aren't afraid to sell players, and they tend to sell players well. And by that, I mean, they get money, they get rid of them at the right time, and they move them on, and they have people to replace them. And if you're thinking that you've got Phil Foden, age 23, to come into this position and get the best out of him, that it wouldn't be a huge loss from City's perspective, it could make sense. From a football fan's perspective watching it, if Kevin De Bruyne went to Saudi Arabia this summer, it would be difficult to understand and swallow, I think.
Jules, can you see it?
I can't really. I can't see it. I just don't think... I think he would much rather go back to Belgium, for example, where he all started, to finish his career.
He's only 32. Why are we talking about finishing?
I mean, he's closer to the end than the beginning, right? So at some point...
He is, but players are still continuing on to a higher level. Yeah, you know, I mean...
Yeah, true, true. KDB with his... The way he plays can play until 38. I won't lie. Yeah. Unless he plays in a secondary league like Belgium, mate.
But he's got the ability, right, to do a Modric, right? He's got the ability to be a little bit deeper and maybe limit his runs. He's got the passing ability. He's comfortable on the ball. If he modifies his game a little bit, he could easily do that job.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I think.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You're right.
Liverpool obviously went in action this weekend in terms of the Premier League, but they played in the League Cup, which they beat Chelsea in. The problem for Liverpool is the number of injuries that they're getting, and like massive, massive injuries. You see what team they finished with. Obviously, they had a team that started that was a good side, but now they've got Gravenberch and Endo left the stadium on crutches. Is this going to hurt Liverpool, Jules?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, they play Southampton in the FA Cup in midweek, which the kids will play. The kids that we saw finishing the League Cup final will play, will start. Simply because there's just nobody else. I mean, soon Schwartz, they'll be on the phone to you to come in and play as a centre-back. No.
Kelleher was absolutely outstanding. I'm a big, big fan of his. And he needs to go and play somewhere regularly if he's not going to play at Liverpool.
No, I agree.
He's not, is he? I want to see him play elsewhere because I think he's that good.
Or you realize now that he's better than Alisson, or soon will be better than Alisson, and it's the time to change. But you're right, he's too good to be left.
Which
on the
could
bench
happen, right? Longer. It could happen in the summer in terms of, you know, if you talk about, which doesn't sound right, but if you talk about changing period, an opportunity to make some changes, it could be in the summer, right? Klopp leaves. Maybe some big name players will go because they just see it as an opportunity for a fresh start. I mean, Liverpool fans are going to go crazy in a second. But do you know what I'm saying, Phil? That is a chance, right?
Yeah, that's a chance.
Are you not happy about that? Or you're not buying into that one?
I'm not overly buying into that one. But no, listen, maybe. It's possible. But you're talking about Liverpool and the injuries, and I've been quite confident that Liverpool are going to get it done in terms of the Premier League this season. And that cup final at the weekend when the kids came on and did really well.
They were really good.
It just feels like this season, when there have been injuries for Liverpool, they've been able to find solutions, and loads of goals have been scored by substitutes from Liverpool this season. And I think the squad depth is big. That said, producer Elliot was telling us just before we came on air, they have literally got a starting 11, a very high quality starting 11 of players out. So the injury crisis is getting to ridiculous levels. But at the moment, they've been able to deal with it.
But we saw on the weekend as well, at the final whistle, two of those starting 11 that were sitting in the stands didn't look too injured, did they? Darwin Nunez, I tell you what, I don't think I've ever seen him run that quickly off out of the stand. How he didn't actually injure himself again. Did you see that, Jules? It was absolutely crazy. And obviously, Szoboszlai as well. And Jurgen Klopp did mention something in his post-match interview about the fact that he was told they weren't fit enough, but Jesus Christ. I mean, maybe they need to do cross-country, steeplechase or something like that, because they look fit for that, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Schwartzy, there was no WSL this weekend, but you must have been pleased to see the Matildas, because they got one foot in the Olympics now with that 3-0 win over Uzbekistan.
I'm not going to lie, I was a little bit concerned, 0-0 at halftime, and just thought, oh no, come on, don't. On paper, this is not a whitewash, but this is a comfortable. Look, we knocked France aside in the World Cup, so we should be beating Uzbekistan. Yeah. delighted. I think it's a great result. Even more so when you look at the other fixture, which was North Korea against Japan. They drew 0-0. I know in North Korea you end up playing on artificial pitches, and it's really, really tough place to go because the Socceroos have played there before. So yes, yeah, so I think it's a great result, and I'm ever so confident now that they'll get the job done and be at the Olympics in your home city, Jules. Yeah,
we can knock you out in the Olympic tournament, which would be lovely. I'll be there as well. I hope you come over for that.
You can hope, mate. You can hope that you can knock us out. And look, I mean, look, France are a good side. Let's be honest. They are a very, very good side. And it was a great game, the quarterfinals of the World Cup. So the Olympics, again, equally great tournament for women's football, and it's going to be really, really exciting to see it. Question I want to ask you, though, Jules, are you doing the Euros as well?
Yes, I am.
Oh, my God. What a summer you're having, by the way. If you're a sports fan, right, Euros and Olympics. Phil?
I'm doing the double as well. Yeah.
And you're doing the double. What? Yeah. Hang on. How do I get on this gig? I'm only doing the Euros. Can I get it? Come along as well?
Yeah, surely. We can find a space for you somewhere.
Yeah, there's going to be loads of free accommodation space in Paris with the Olympics. And yeah, also, it's going to be easy to find somewhere.
We're looking for someone who can do badminton coverage. And Schwarzy, I bet you know a lot.
I will do anything. I will do anything to get to the Olympics. I've never been. I'd like to go. I watched two events at the London Olympics in 2012 because I was in the city. But other than that, that's the only time I've ever been anywhere near an Olympic Games.
I actually had to commentate some badminton at the last Olympics.
We need to find this tape.
I was on Wikipedia 5 minutes before, like, checking the rules and everything. So yeah, I'm not a badminton expert.
Did you get asked back?
No.
Yeah, I'm going. Hopefully not badminton. Like I'm doing football, but when you go there, you have to have an eye on, you know, be able to jump in and help out if a commentator goes down.
So, I just hope you get badminton again. Oh, that'd be absolutely.
I did badminton. I did triple fencing. Jump. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, fencing. Yeah, fencing as well. That'd be great. Ooh,
yeah, yeah.
Shooting.
And tennis as well.
The shooting.
Yeah, no. Oh no, shooting.
Can't wait. Coming up next, we'll be chatting La Liga. But first, here's a taste of what we've got coming up on Optus Sport.
The title race is on a knife's edge in the Women's Super League.
And she's done it!
City and Chelsea equal top, Arsenal just 3 points behind. Next Saturday night, can City make it 9 wins in a row? They take on Everton. Sunday night, the Aussie North London Derby. Charlie Grant and Spurs take on the Aussies at Arsenal. Monday, Gorries West Ham host Manchester United. And can Chelsea bounce back from their loss to City? They head to Leicester. That's next week on the Women's Super League.
La Liga that was on this weekend, of course, Real Madrid at home to Sevilla. Phil, you've mentioned it before, Real Madrid TV, about the pressure they put on match officials. Tell us what happened on the week, like leading up to this game.
Well, Real Madrid TV have decided to change their editorial line in the last few years. And now, before every game, they produce a video on the match official for that particular game, highlighting decisions that he has taken which have gone against Real Madrid in previous matches. It is something that has caused quite a lot of controversy here in Spain. It is a practice that not that many people are in favour of, to be honest. You speak to your average Real Madrid fan and they're like, why are we doing these videos? And the thing is, I know everybody complains about referees. Managers complain about referees after the game. Players say, you know, this didn't go our way. But Real Madrid TV are doing this video before the game, and they're doing the video with the implication that somehow the referee has got it in for Real Madrid, is against Real Madrid, consistently takes decisions that are not in favour of Real Madrid. So what Sevilla did before this game, they've actually put an official complaint to La Liga about these videos. I'm not sure it's going to come to anything, but they felt by the video that was produced on Friday ahead of the weekend game, they felt, no, this is not fair. This is conditioning how the referee is going to approach the game. And they've made an official complaint. Like I said, I don't think too much is going to come of it. But it's like an aggressive tactic from Real Madrid's marketing arm, which Real Madrid TV is part of. It is a marketing tool to get across the club's message, like a club website, like a club social media channel. The TV channel is the same. And yeah, I think they're going to keep doing it. They're pretty happy to keep producing these videos. As it goes, the referee ruled out a goal against Real Madrid for a foul in the build up in the first half, which may or may not build into the conspiracy theories. But
he got substituted, right? He got substituted in the second
half. It was quite. It was quite surreal. I've never actually seen a referee go off injured. He was.
I have. I've seen it before. I've seen it before as well.
Not in La Liga. I felt bad for him because I was there in the stadium. There were 75,000 people looking at him, going, "What are you doing? What are you going to be? You got injured." So we had to wait for the next referee to come on, and it was all a bit of a faff. And then the next referee came on, and he was a bit more sort of permissive and let the game flow a little bit more.
Real Madrid won. Yeah, you said you were at the stadium, and you also heard very much how Sergio Ramos received like his reception at the stadium. What was that like?
So I like to go to games to watch matches
every now and then.
I just think you get a better perspective in the stadium, you know, and it's really important to go.
That's only a new thing, right?
Even if you're not covering the game, I think it's important to go to the stadium, Schwartzy. You know, just
that's a new thing for you, isn't it? Because you're pretty new to this. That's why you're buzzing about it. Like, I've been to many games where I've actually never been a support, like never been working. Kind of ish.
Yeah, not in the last 5 or 6 years. But yeah, I went there. And I went there to see what the reception was going to be like for Sergio Ramos, because it was the first time he was going back to the Bernabeu as a Sevilla player against Real Madrid for 20 years. And he got whistled. He got whistled by, it wasn't the majority of Real Madrid fans, that's true. It was, a small minority, and whistles do carry quite loudly. So you only need a few people to be whistling for it to sound quite loudly. But yeah, every time he touched the ball, he got whistled, and I was surprised. And we thought that there might be some kind of homage paid to him before the game. We thought there might be a banner. We thought there might be a minute's applause in the fourth minute for his number four. And there was none of that. I think his name got cheered when it was read out on the Tannoy system before. Okay, fair enough. But then during the game, there were some people whistling, and I was really, really surprised at that. I did not expect that at all.
Made me think as well, Jules, Kylian Mbappe. Obviously, 99.999% sure that he's going to Real Madrid. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. I wanted to ask the question, when he goes back and plays against PSG, will he get booed or whistled or screamed at?
It's a good question. I mean, we don't know. We won't know until it happens. What we know.
What's your gut feeling?
I don't know. Yesterday, for example, was the first home game at the Parc des Princes, where since he announced he was leaving to go to Real Madrid, and it was normal reception. There was no booing, no whistling, nothing. They just, when his name was announced, they clapped and they shouted his name like they always do. So it was not more, but it was certainly not less than usual. When he would come, whenever he comes back with a different shirt, whether it's a Real Madrid shirt or another shirt, I don't think it would be different. Again, he gave PSG and PSG fans 7 great years. He broke all the records. He went to a Champions League final.
Ramos did the same thing, right? So it doesn't make any difference.
I guess it changes like the way that you leave. And Ramos left in a certain way that people didn't necessarily agree with. And it was actually, there was quite a big contrast last night, because Luka Modric scored the winning goal last night. Luka Modric is someone who has stayed at Real Madrid, and he's signed 1-year contract extensions every year for the last 4 or 5 years, which is what Sergio Ramos did not want to do. He was offered a 1-year contract extension. He said, no, I'm Sergio Ramos. Give me 2 years at least. And the club said, no. And then he realized that he didn't get any other offers. And then he came back and said, all right, I'll sign. And Florentino Perez, in big boss mode, says the offer has expired. So he was, you know, that's how he left.
Yeah.
He didn't leave in the best way. So which is why I think Real Madrid fans, some Real Madrid fans felt it necessary to whistle.
So Jules, on the Mbappe, I've seen you tweet some stuff. It's not done yet. It's agreed, verbally.
Yeah. There's still a few things to sort out in the discussions, the contract. I mean, we can say it again. One is the Olympics, again, because he really wants to play, because he's in Paris, in France. And this is really the only opportunity he will have in his career to play in home soil for the Olympics. But for Real Madrid, if you sign a player like him, who is your marquee signing? The Olympics are July 26th even slightly before for the football tournament, to August 10th. It's not the right time, and it's not FIFA dates either. So they're discussing that. And also image rights. And as Kitro knows, image rights at Real Madrid are very specific for everyone, from Cristiano to Beckham to Ronaldo to Bellingham to Vinicius. It's 50-50. Kylian wants more than 50%. So to own his own image right more than 50%. So this is also something, it's not something that is going to make the contract fall through, but it's just something that needs a little bit of time to agree on different terms and different structures.
Kylian Mbappe trying to go to the Olympics instead of going on Real Madrid's pre-season tour. wow, that is never going to happen, man. Yeah. They are going to say, you need to come on tour with us because you are going to make us a lot of money, so you've got to come.
So how would that be taken if Kylian Mbappe does sign for Real Madrid and then opts not to go to the Paris Olympics? Will he also, how will French public react to that?
And I mean, they won't really, because again, if your club doesn't want to release you, there's nothing you can do. And Thierry Henry has three players over 23 that he can pick. Griezmann wants to go, for example, with Atleti, let him go. I'm not so sure. I think someone like Lloris would love to go with LAFC. Let him again. So we go to the same discussion, and Thierry had a big meeting recently with all the clubs in France, Ligue 1 and Ligue 2, so first and second division, to say, listen, I know you don't have to release your players, but this is very important for French football in general. So let's try to have the most competitive team for men and women at the Olympics. But he knows it will be difficult, and he might get to a point where Griezmann can't make it, Mbappe can't make it, Lloris can't make it, Saliba can't make it, Upamecano. So all the players that he might want in his team, none of them might be able to do it. So it's a bit tricky. And to be fair, I understand it on one way, and club have their rights. And like Phil said, preseason is very important for a lot of clubs. And also, if you're a new signing, not just for marketing reasons, but to get to know your manager, your teammates, doing those friendly matches, it's important. You've been there, Schwarzy. So it's important. I get that. But it's also the Olympics, and it's also a big tournament, and a lot of players want to be involved in it. So I don't know what the answer is, really.
I think Henry, all he needs to do is call a few mates and get a few mates in there. I mean, Zidane's free. Deschamps is free. Look, I mean, I think they can still do a job in midfield as well, those lot. Yeah, be interesting to see. Very exciting time, certainly with the Euros. And, of course, which the Euros are live on Optus Sport. And the Olympics after, which will be, what a year of sport. It's going to be amazing. And, of course, then when the new season starts, La Liga, Mbappe, if he's at Real Madrid, the Premier League season, WSL, everything else that goes with it. Fantastic. Really looking forward to it. Barcelona, most
just
convincing
one thing, Schwarzy, before we move on. The Modric goal, incredible. The shot and the curler. But for me, the first touch is what makes it so special, because it's so difficult. The ball is spinning. It bounces just in front of him. And yet the touch is perfect to set him up then for the curler. And I just wanted to show him a bit of love.
The thing about Modric, which really, really impresses me, is that there's so many things that impress me. But when he first arrived at the club, the level of criticism they kind of received for a player that wasn't perceived to be a Real Madrid Galactico because he didn't fit the image was astounding. But way he's actually taken it and developed it and owned it and dominated has been sensational, not only for Real Madrid, but also for Croatia.
I think a lot of people didn't know where he played as well when he joined Real Madrid. So I think a lot of people were expecting him to come in and be a number 10, play just off the striker, and that wasn't necessarily where he wanted to play. He was actually voted the worst summer signing on a poll on the website Marca in 2012 by some very silly people who have been made to look very, very silly subsequently. But yeah, that just gives you an idea like of the feeling towards him when he came. He's had to work hard to become a Real Madrid legend, and now he is very much a Real Madrid legend. And also after that goal, it was quite telling the celebration, because everybody, I mean, he didn't start the game, by the way, came on as a substitute. Everybody, all the team came and celebrated with him, and they sort of lifted him up onto the advertising hoardings, and he stood up there a bit like with the Jude Bellingham celebration, arms aloft, cheering at the fans. And that was kind of indicative of the players kind of rallying around him, because I don't think he's happy with the role that he has at the moment in the Real Madrid team. He is a squad player at the moment. There isn't a place for him in the first choice starting 11, which is difficult for someone like Modric to accept. He's 38, he's going to be 39 in October. It's very difficult for someone of that age to be in the first choice starting 11 of a team as big as Real Madrid. I think he's having difficulties accepting that, and I think we might see him leave in the summer. But yeah, he celebrated that goal pretty well.
Because he also has a very contentious relationship with Carlo Ancelotti since that, because of that very reason, right?
Yeah, there were suggestions that Modric is not happy with Ancelotti, because he was told in the summer that he would still have an important role to play. He would still be in the first team, and that has not necessarily gone according to what he was expecting. So, but listen, he's an extraordinarily professional guy, Luka Modric. That's why he is at the top level still at the age of 38 and a half, because he looks after himself, because he trains unbelievably hard, and because he's got this ridiculous desire to win and to succeed and to be at the top. And he's completely obsessed by football as well. He goes home, he watches football. He's someone who lives for football. He's not one of these footballers who goes home and, you know, plays PlayStation or something. He loves football. It's his life. And you can see that reflected. And that's how you've got to be if you want to be at the top level for so, so long, which is what he's done.
Let's move on to Barcelona against Getafe. It's the first performance from Barcelona under Xavi since he's announcing he's leaving the end of the season that you kind of go, right, that's what you kind of expect from Barcelona's side, Phil?
It's been the best performance from Barcelona since, I think, the end of September when they beat Real Betis 5-0. Since then, we haven't seen them win convincingly at all. We've barely seen them win any matches by more than a one-goal margin. I think, you know, the previous week I was here talking about waiting to see a reaction from this Barcelona side. And Xavi has gone on and on and on since his decision to leave in the summer, since he announced his decision. The results have actually been pretty good. It's 12 points from 15, but the performances up until the weekend have not been good at all. And at every moment, he's tried to revindicate himself, saying, oh, well, you see, I announced that I'm going and this has had a reaction and we're playing well and, you know, we're picking up points. And it's been difficult to buy into that argument until this weekend, when we actually did see a reaction and they played well against Napoli in the Champions League. I don't want to be a downer, but Getafe made it very easy for them. They did not play well at all. They played with a really strange high line that wasn't worked well at all, and Barcelona could just pick them off with balls over the top. So it was a pretty comfortable afternoon at the office for Barcelona, but it's what they needed and something that they haven't had for a very, very long time.
We touched on it last week about the fact that Rayo obviously haven't been playing well, and you were quietly concerned about they may be getting relegated, but the fact is that the three teams down the bottom are so bad. Cardiff drew at home to Celta Vigo, which obviously is a big blow for their chances of staying up. Point difference, it's only 3 points though. But do you see those three teams, Cardiff, Granada, Almeria, the three that go down and doesn't change?
Yes, I think they are the three that are going down now. The thing is, Almeria are bottom of the table, right? They've got 9 points.
They haven't won a single game yet.
No. They haven't won a single game. They've played 26 matches this season. They haven't won a single game. They are on course to potentially be the worst team in the history of La Liga. And yet, I genuinely don't think they're the worst team in the division this season. They drew 2-2 with Atletico Madrid this weekend, which was a really good result for them. Luca Romero, on his debut, scoring 2 goals for them. And Atletico Madrid once again dropping points away from home, which has been a really massive problem for them this season. But Almeria are a side that have, as they say in Spanish, they have football in them. They can play nice football. They can score goals. They are an attractive team to watch. They are just, their confidence is shot. And they're on course to not win all season. And they've been so close against the big teams as well. They've been so close against Real Madrid, so close against Barcelona. They've drawn with Girona. They've drawn with Athletic Club. They're a team that can play well. They just can't win. They just can't win. But they are, I'm not saying always watch Almeria, but they are an entertaining team. Yeah.
Real Sociedad, are they out of the chance, out of the hopes of finishing in Champions League? I mean, they've dropped off a little bit. Champions League performance as well wasn't great, but do you think they're out of the chances of finishing top four?
Am I going to keep doing this? If we're talking about goals scored, then definitely don't always watch Real Sociedad, because their problem have been scoring goals at home. And it should be a fortress, their home stadium, and it isn't. But they scored 2 goals in their last 5 games. They went 567 minutes without scoring before the previous week, and they won away at Mallorca. I think they're showing that they've been, the squad is too short to compete on not just the Champions League, but they've got to the semi-finals of the Copa del Rey as well. And they've got a two-legged semi-final coming up for them. And it's difficult for a young squad like theirs to compete on three fronts. And I think we're seeing that their form in the La Liga has paid for that. But listen, they're in the semi-finals of the Copa del Rey. They will probably make the final there. They will probably get knocked out by PSG. But listen, Jules, I mean, we saw them play against PSG last week. They played so well, didn't they?
Yeah, I was there. I thought the first half was really good. They were the better team. The second half, I think physically the intensity dropped, doesn't it? After an hour anyway, the way they press. And then PSG were good, much better in the second half once Luis Enrique shouted in the dressing room at the players. But it's a shame because you could tell there's something missing, but not much really for them to be a top five contender. Right now, they're 9 points behind Athletic Club for the fifth place, which should be a Champions League spot for Spain for next season if things go well for them in the current European campaigns. They're 12 points behind fourth, though. That's so fourth is a bit too far. But the thing is, teams around them, teams around them are also doing well and playing well. So it might be a little bit tricky.
Euros are 4 months away. I want to put you on the spot. It's not on the run sheet. I've just gone left field. I want to hear from both of you. Who's your favourite right now to win the Euros?
He's gone left field, Jules. Go first.
Okay, I go first. France, of course.
Obviously.
But
not
outside
South
of
Korea, like you're gonna wear a South Korean shirt again?
If France win the World, the Euros, I wear Australian shirt for like 2 weeks or 3 weeks in a row.
Promise?
I promise you. England, this has to be England's tournament. This is probably quite likely to be Southgate's last tournament. If you look at the key players in that team, from Bellingham to Foden to Kane, just to name three, they are a much higher level and much better form than they ever been in their career, really. And you can even add Rice to this. So this is surely their tournament. And I know the pressure will be there. And I know there are other really good teams, especially France, I guess, who are the other outstanding favourite for me. But really, this has to be England's tournament.
I think France and England are... I was going to say way ahead. I would put maybe Portugal just fractionally below them. And then there's quite a big jump to the next sort of group of potential suitors. But if you just look at the France team, it's so ridiculous that it's difficult to see past it. And it's a team that, has had success in the past. And England very much have not. So in terms of actually winning things, there's been progression in terms of reaching the latter stages of major tournaments, which didn't necessarily happen in the previous decade or so. And now they've had experience of that, but they haven't gone on to win things. And it just feels like, now or never for England, given the insane talent they have. But if you're asking me who I think is going to win, I think it's France. I think their squad is just absolutely ridiculous. And their starting 11 is better than everyone else's.
I'm going to lean towards France as well because of the know-how. Obviously, got to the World Cup final, have won the Euros, won the World Cup more recently. England are in danger of being a Belgium. The team of a generation that don't win anything. And I think that could be the case. I agree as well with everything you're saying. England on form, player for player, are the most informed team, and team should win it. But France are very, very good as well. And I'm going to say Germany as well.
What?
I know. I've got to say Germany just because you're at home.
All right. Well, I'll say Greece then.
I feel sorry for them. Look, we've even gone back to Tony Cruz to get Tony Cruz back in the side, right? even though he's a really, really good player. Don't get me wrong, Phil. Phil, it's okay. I know he's a top-class player. He's one of the best players in the world.
He is a really, really good player. One of the best players of all time.
Problem is with Germany is Nagelsmann is still trying to find a team. He doesn't know what team he has. He doesn't know what players to play. He can't find it. He doesn't know. They're running out of time.
Play Tony Cruz, obviously.
Yeah. No, absolutely. He's come out of retirement. He's called him, got on the phone, and we'll see Tony Cruz at the Euros unless something dramatically happens, certainly injury. But let's hope he's there because Germany certainly need him. Anyway, thanks for listening to the Optus Sport Football Podcast. Remember, you can watch every game in the J-League, where this weekend Harry Kewell got a win in his first game as Yokohama manager. And as always, the Premier League and La Liga are both live and exclusive on Optus Sport. See you next time.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.